Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Azadeh Mashiri. We start with what some call the forgotten war. Sudan has been gripped by a violent struggle for power for more than a year between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. Addressing the UN General Assembly, the army commander General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan accused some countries in the region of supporting the RSF.
Sudan is facing very serious challenges. There is a conspiracy, a war that has been waged by a group that has rebelled against the state for many years, receiving political and logistical support at a local and regional levels. You've all witnessed the crimes and violations and atrocities committed by these rebels, targeting the Sudanese people and the Sudanese state.
The BBC has been on a rare trip to Omdurman, part of Sudan's capital, and one of the battlefields of the civil war. Civilians are suffering from regular shelling, and women living in RSF-held areas have shared devastating accounts of rape and sexual violence with our correspondent, Barbara Plettusher.
I'm on the outskirts of Omdurman at a transit point for people who are coming out of RSF-held territory into an area that is controlled by the army. Some of them are walking, some of them are coming on donkey carts, some of them are fleeing permanently to a safer area, others are crossing the line so that they can go to a market and buy goods more cheaply and then go back to their homes. And we have been hearing horrific stories about what life is like under the RSF. So what was it like coming here? What was your journey like?
Very difficult, these women tell me. At every RSF checkpoint we had to pay, they say. They walked for 4 hours to buy food. Their husbands can't leave the house for fear of being beaten or detained.
What about the women? Are the women safe or unsafe?
The chorus of voices died down, until one woman burst out.
There are so many women here who've been raped, but they don't talk about it. What difference would it make anyway? Some girls, the RSF makes them lie in the streets at night. If they come back late from this market, the RSF keeps them for 5 or 6 days.
As she spoke, her mother sat with head in hand, sobbing. Other women around her also started crying.
You in your world, if your child went out, would you leave her? Wouldn't you go look for her? What can we do? Nothing is in our hands. No one cares for us. We are cut off.
I asked them why they didn't leave. We're too poor, they told me. We have nowhere else to go. The capital is still an active war zone. In Omdurman, we were escorted at all times by the army.
We're traveling at quite a speed because there's been shelling this morning, and we heard a mortar strike land what seemed quite close to us just a few minutes ago. So the military is telling us we have to travel quickly in order to avoid any chance of getting hit by artillery fire.
It's the shelling that's claiming many civilian lives. Casualties are brought here to El Nau, the largest emergency hospital. In the past week, it's received dozens.
One of them, this patient, hit by a shrapnel in the neck.
The head doctor, Jamal Al-Tayeb, is leaning over the bed of 15-year-old Sufian Shawish.
The boy was working at a market when a mortar landed close by.
The bomb hit the wall in front of me. My friend screamed for help. They put me in a minibus. There was blood coming out of my nose and mouth.
He's now paralyzed from the neck down. Soufiane's mother, Miriam Sanusi, had asked him to leave the market shortly before the attack.
He's got his whole life ahead of him. He's still a young man. And to be hit like this, to become paralyzed, it's very hard to bear. I hope that people will help my son. I don't have money for the operation.
But it's sexual violence that's become a defining characteristic of the conflict. Both sides are accused of war crimes, but the RSF more so than the army, especially when it comes to rape. They deny the charges. One woman tells us her own story. She now works at a tea stall in the market at the transit point. But at the beginning of the war, she says, armed men broke into her house demanding to rape her two daughters. The youngest was 10 years old. We've chosen to protect her identity for her safety.
I told the girls to stay behind me, and I said to the RSF, if you want to rape anyone, it has to be me. They hit me and told me to take off my clothes. Before I took them off, I told my girls to leave, and they jumped over the fence. Then one of the men laid on me.
The other women we met are gathering now to begin the trek back home. For as long as this war goes on, they have no choice but to return to its horrors.
That was from our correspondent Barbara Platt Usher, who is joining me now. Barbara, some painful testimony in those accounts. In what ways has sexual violence, in the UN's words, been used as a tool of war? What have you witnessed?
Well, the senior UN official has called sexual violence in this war as being used as a weapon of war. And it is something that the UN fact-finding commission has detailed, it has recorded, and it blames mostly on the RSF. It has said that there have been some cases of rape and rape threats documented from the army side, but mostly on a large scale in the way we've been hearing it described, that is attributed to the RSF and its allied militias. It's something that the RSF has denied. It says that there are some cases, perhaps, of human rights abuses, but that they investigate them and sentence people who carry them out. But again, you know, this kind of testimony that you hear, I'd actually gone to this transit point to talk to people who I thought would be fleeing from RSF-held territories, and then came across these women, and eventually, over talking to them, you know, found out all about these horrors just underneath the surface. And as they opened up, other women around them did as well. So it's you know, you can imagine that it's very widespread. I think we don't have numbers. They're very hard to get, but it has been a story that's consistently been given by people who are in territory that has been taken over by the Rapid Support Forces.
Right, and that's rare access that you've been given. Barbara, thank you for that. Now, the conflict has triggered one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. That's according to the UN. We spoke to the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, about a recent UN fact-finding mission that documented several cases of rape and rape threats from both sides.
Unfortunately, we have seen rape as a weapon of war, particularly by RSF and the allied militias, but also we have had evidence of sexual violence committed by the Sudanese armed forces. So unfortunately, rape, sexual violence is a despicable feature of this conflict, and it just shows what they're trying to do in order to exercise power and domination.
Well, the Middle East, Ukraine, how have these major conflicts had an impact on the support, the help people of Sudan need?
I think it's one thing that I feel very strongly about, that Sudan seems to have fallen off the headlines. It's very good that actually BBC focuses on it, and we need to bring it back into the headlines, because the people of Sudan are suffering on a daily basis in unseen ways that really require an all-out effort by the international community to do whatever they can to stop this war and to get this country back to the original hope that I felt myself when I was in Sudan 2 years ago and I met the people who overthrew the brutal suppression by the former regime under al-Bashir. And I only hope we can find the energy to get it back to where it started a couple of years ago.
And when it comes to the energy you're talking about, what challenges has the UN faced in delivering aid to Sudan, given the need is so urgent?
If you look at the needs, over half of the population, that is 25.6 million people, are facing acute hunger. We have close to 8.5 million people internally displaced because of how the war goes around in the country. And we have massive problems in delivering humanitarian assistance and humanitarian access because both parties are putting obstacles to fundamental humanitarian principles. So we are really in a very desperate situation.
So who can make the difference then? Who could help solve some of those challenges?
It starts with the Security Council. Whoever has any influence over the parties, both at the regional level, at the international level, one clear message: silence the guns, stop the war, go to the negotiation table, and come back to civilian rule.
The US has been trying to broker a ceasefire.
Yeah.
Where do those efforts stand today?
Well, there have been these ongoing efforts. I know that also, I just came back from New York, there were a couple of meetings that were held in the margins of the UN General Assembly in New York. I just hope that it brings the dynamism and energy into all these efforts so that finally these negotiations lead to something. But to be honest, I'm not privy to where we are on the actual state of the negotiation.
Well, it's complicated, isn't it? Because we often talk about this as the RSF and the Sudanese army, but there are other countries, other players in this, aren't there?
Well, it is, and that's unique. Because in the past, what we have seen in Sudan is always a fight between the central government and some of the rebel groups. Now, ever since April last year, we have seen both security institutions fighting each other and taking along different ethnic and tribal affiliations and militias, those who have interests. And we don't have documented evidence of who is really involved, but I'm sure there are people who are supporting of either party, and they need to stop doing that. And it's really important to focus on that as well.
Now, turning to the humanitarian crisis, before I let you go, we've focused this report on the sexual violence that is being experienced by these women. But children are also deeply affected by this crisis, aren't they?
Yes, they are, because you can imagine if war is a feature of daily life, there are no schools that are really working for them. Their mental health is affected. And unfortunately, we have also evidence of minors being raped and where sexual violence has been committed. You can imagine what this means for a child growing up in Sudan at this point in time.
That was the UN Human Rights Commissioner, Volker Turk. And I also do want to point you to our website, bbc.com/news. There is a long piece by Barbara Platt-Usher, our correspondent there, who received rare access to Sudan in the midst of this civil war. And in the last few minutes, we've also received some news that the actress Dame Maggie Smith, known for the Harry Potter films and Downton Abbey, has died at the age of 89. That's according to her family. We'll have more later on in this programme. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the American film director Francis Ford Coppola is celebrated for films such as Apocalypse Now and The Godfather. But now, in his 80s, he spent over $100 million of his own money making Megalopolis. But could it become a Megaflopolis? A film critic gave us her thoughts.
Megalopolis is a very ambitious film. You could say it's ahead of its time. I think the film is messy and oftentimes incoherent. It feels like Coppola is trying to stuff a dozen disparate ideas into one film without logic or reason.
That's coming up in 20 minutes. And a reminder that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is due to address the UN General Assembly in New York. We'll have more on that later in the programme. This is NewsHour live from London. Let's turn to an election result in Japan. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party has elected a new leader, and that means Ishibe Shigeru will become the new Prime Minister of Japan. He replaces Prime Minister Kishida, who decided to step down. The LDP has had to reckon with a scandal over the misuse of funds, and candidates campaigned on a promise they would be a safe pair of hands during a precarious time for the party. So is Ishibe Shigeru the one who can steady the ship? Arfia Eri is an MP with the governing party, LDP. Was she happy with today's result?
I had endorsed Taro Kono, one of the candidates, and our current digital minister, one of his 20 endorsers. However, you know, having 9 candidates run and not knowing, you know, who would win until the last minute, it was a sight to see. And it was an experience, to say the least.
Also, if this wasn't the result you were hoping for, do you believe Ishibe Shigeru will be able to distance the LDP from a series of scandals and unify the party?
The slush fund scandal and the need for more transparent and clean and open politics and the need for the LDP to reform itself and revise itself to truly change and win back the trust of the Japanese people, that was discussed throughout the electoral process. And I think all candidates had great ideas as to how to bring that forward. Obviously, Ishibe Shigeru has been arguing for transparent and clean politics for quite some time.
And when you look at global affairs, former Prime Minister Kishida deepened Japan's alliance with the US, and that's at a time when both countries see China as a major concern. Do you believe that Ishibe Shigeru would do the same? What has he campaigned on?
Along with US-Japan alliance is, you know, constitutional reform. The LDP has for a long time argued that we need to revise our constitution, which is very pacifist. It doesn't even have our self-defense forces written in the constitution as, you know, something that is constitutionally approved of. This electoral process also has revived debates on that and how this reform must be enacted very quickly. As regards to US-Japan alliance, my expectation is that, you know, now that he is the leader of the party, he will continue with Prime Minister Kishida's policies, but we have yet to see how that will unfold.
And he's also campaigned on the idea of an Asian NATO of sorts.
Yes, he has. It's quite evident that he understands the threat of China and how we as Japan lie within the context currently of global shrinking space for human rights, shrinking space for democracies, rise of authoritarianism, and the need for us to really partner and align with other countries of like-minded values in order to defend the principles we very much strongly believe in, the principles of democracy and human rights.
You're of Uyghur heritage. You've pushed for more representation of Japan's diversity in politics. Do you think Ishibe Shigeru could help lead some of that change?
I have definitely advocated for better representation within our politics, not just for candidates like myself, but also, you know, of youth empowerment, having more young people into politics, bringing more women into politics, and also Japanese people of diverse careers and diverse family and economic backgrounds.
Well, you mentioned having more women in politics, and this was a chance to have Japan's first female prime minister. What is your experience of being a woman in Japanese politics?
It was actually quite an experience to be sitting in the room today as the finalists were announced, knowing that a woman came so close to becoming a prime minister and the votes were, you know, incredibly, incredibly close. And so, you know, you could really feel the energy in that room, the tension in that room and this excitement that, you know, we are at a historical point in time where, you know, we had a male and a female candidate head to head in the final process of this election. My experience working as a woman within the parliament and within the LDP actually has been surprisingly better than what I had expected coming in. I definitely feel heard and feel seen, and I look forward to more women joining us in order to make sure that level of representation is even more seen.
That was the MP Arfia Eri from the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan. Now, as companies grapple with the future of AI, they're now being warned about the use of artificial intelligence to carry out so-called CEO fraud. More victims are coming forward with stories of being targeted using generative AI techniques. One case in Hong Kong reportedly saw an AI clone used during a video meeting to trick staff into losing $25 million. But while some fear the rise of AI clones, companies, including Zoom, say we should be excited about a future where your clone can go to a virtual meeting on your behalf. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy and his clone report.
Hello, Joe. What is it that Joe Tidy likes to do for fun?
I enjoy participating in triathlons, marathons and wild swimming. I also like golfing and am a movie geek.
Did you spot the difference there? The first voice was me. The second was an AI clone of me. Not just my voice, my face too, albeit a bit twitchy and with a lot of blinking.
What are your thoughts on artificial intelligence?
I believe artificial intelligence AI has immense transformative potential. It can revolutionize.
Aside from the long delays, it works pretty well one-on-one. But what happens if I send my clone to a work meeting?
Hi, team. Thank you very much. Sorry, I had to nip downstairs to do something. So, Joe, can you update us on what you're working on?
How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Oh, it is AI, isn't it?
It's AI. It's definitely AI. I said it was AI to start with. The blinking was so weird.
What's he saying?
People. It's pretty fascinating stuff. By the way, my connection's been a bit dodgy today, so if I'm slow to respond, you know why. So I'm waiting for that one.
This AI clone was fooling no one then, but there's growing excitement about the tech. Zoom's CEO says we'll one day be able to send our clones to meetings on our behalf. But of course, criminals are experimenting too. Police in Hong Kong are investigating after cyber fraudsters used some sort of AI face and voice cloning to trick an employee during a live work video meeting. $25 million was transferred in the fake deal in February, thought to be the first case of criminals using live cloning tools to carry out so-called CEO fraud. But voice cloning attacks are now far more common.
Martin, upon signing the NDI, I will be able to furnish you with additional details to ensure the successful completion of this operation.
In his central London office, Martin Greenfield, the CEO of security company Cube Orbis, shows me the voice notes that he thought were from his new boss.
Yeah, I mean, they were quite lifelike. And actually, later on in the process, when I actually forwarded these to someone who's known him for years, he actually said, OK, well, that actually could be Marco.
Martin was very nearly tricked into transferring £800,000 to the criminals.
So presumably the criminals would have taken maybe even that video, put it through a machine, then made your bespoke voice notes.
Absolutely. Only need a few seconds, apparently, of speech to work with, and they pick up the mannerisms, they pick up the kind of way in the language and the way it's used, and actually quite believable.
Martin only spotted the scam after triple-checking an email address used by the scammers pretending to be a lawyer. All the perils and positives of AI clones are coming at us fast.
Great to see you back. What would you like to talk about today?
My clone's creator, Suna Linnarup from Friar AI, says there is real potential in this technology.
There are differences in expectations. If I'm telling you I have created a digital twin, it acts exactly like me, you would soon tell me that, no, this is not you. On the other hand, if I say, hey, I have an assistant, it's an AI, you'd have a completely different set of expectations. Face swapping technology does cost a lot of money to do right. But again, everything gets cheaper and it happens so fast.
Clearly, we're going to have to start working a lot harder to make sure we know who's on the other side of that screen.
If you ever have more questions or want to chat again, feel free to reach out. Have a wonderful day.
That was the BBC's Joe Tidy.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now let's get to that story from Australia. By wanting to take that perfect selfie, photographers are having a detrimental impact on endangered species. Again, that's according to experts from Curtin University and Edith Cowan University in Australia in a study they've called Liked to Death. That's why they're calling for stronger codes of conduct. I spoke to one of the authors, Professor Bill Bateman, and I asked him why.
What we wanted to make clear is not that there's anything wrong with people going out and seeing animals and plants, going bird watching and taking photographs. The trouble now is that with the rise of social media, it's so easy to share this information with so many people that we end up with a situation where many species, many individuals of species, start becoming exposed to too much attention. So when someone takes a photograph of a beautiful orchid or a breeding bird, and that encourages other people to go and see it, we end up with a situation which is a kind of tragedy of the commons, which is where just each individual person thinks, well, I'm not doing any damage. But then the sort of cumulative effect can be such that it affects the breeding ability of the animal, or it causes the trampling of the plants, or in the worst situations, you get entirely unethical people who go there to poach the plants or to catch the lizards or the birds that are there.
And is there any sort of policing or code of conduct currently?
There are lots of codes that people put out about the best way to behave around breeding animals, for instance. Those are fantastic. The trouble is, although there is a global community of birdwatchers, there's a global community of plant and animal photographers, and while most people are entirely ethical and entirely right in their behavior, all it requires is a few bad actors who choose not to follow the ethical rules. And that damage they do can be absolutely enormous. And it's only a small percentage of the people who are actually going out there and enjoying seeing this wildlife. And it's very difficult to gatekeep this, of course, because it's an informal community.
So what's your message to people who want to see these endangered species, possibly for the last time?
I'm guilty of this as well, or at least I'm involved in this. I go out every weekend to see things. We have to start making choices. One thing is that we have to accept that we have to behave in a very ethical way. The other is that perhaps we have to make a choice that sometimes we don't actually need to go and see these things. And a good example would be there's a breeding bird, a laughing thrush in China, which is such a popular bird to go and see and photograph that its behavior, its breeding behavior, has started changing at the sites where it's photographed. And it starts nesting higher in trees, and it starts breeding at a different time of year. Now, when that sort of impact happens, how many people do we actually want to encourage to go and see that bird? And some people encourage the idea that we don't actually need to do this.
That was Professor Bill Bateman from Curtin University. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Azadeh Mashiri. Let's turn to the Middle East. Israel and Hezbollah have exchanged fresh attacks as Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu prepares to address the UN General Assembly in New York. Nearly 800 people have been killed in Israeli strikes since Monday. That's according to Lebanese officials. And this week, key Arab countries, the UAE, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, grouped together at the UN to push the warring parties to agree to a 21-day ceasefire. They were alongside the UK and the United States, amongst others. The BBC Michelle Hussein spoke to Khalid bin Bandar Al Saud, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to London. What does he make of the view that Israel might be able to forever put an end to Hezbollah's hostilities one day?
Well, I think forever is a long time. One has to really question that long-term strategy. It's simple to look at this as short-term tactics and the aims that they may be achieving. If you like to simplify it, if you take a reservoir that the Israelis want to drain, they're draining it pretty well. The problem is the reservoir is filled from a source. And what the Israelis are doing currently is they're not just draining the reservoir, they're destroying everything around it. And in doing so, they're creating more sources for the reservoir. Sure, it might empty in the short term, but it'll refill.
You mean they're creating more hatred towards Israel?
Exactly. And if they want to solve the problem, the solution is simple. The simple solution is a Palestinian state and a solution to the Palestinian cause. Now, executing that is difficult. There's no question. It's not easy. But if they don't address the core problem, there will always be a problem.
The solution is a Palestinian state. How could Saudi Arabia be part of achieving a Palestinian state in a way that still makes Israel feel secure?
If we hit a direction towards a Palestinian state and we can bring, I don't know about this Israeli government, but an Israeli government to the table that commits to that, that changes the whole dynamic of what's happening on the ground. We have been doing this and pushing for a Palestinian state very openly since 1981. That has not changed. Our position has not changed. Our aim has not changed. And we will do everything we can to get there.
You can't choose the makeup of an Israeli government, obviously. With this Israeli government, would you be prepared to talk to them again about the normalization of relations as you were very close to agreeing such a normalization before October the 7th?
We've been calling for a ceasefire, most importantly. We need to stop killing and destruction and the despair that's being created. A week ago, we were talking about a ceasefire in Gaza. Now we're talking about a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon. Where next? So for us, that is the immediate focus. If we get there and we get commitments to a Palestinian state, I don't see why we wouldn't talk to the Israeli government. But at the moment, instead of trying to normalize with its friends, it's normalizing violence and destruction and despicable behavior.
Well, that's why I asked if you'd still be prepared to have those talks on normalization because of the huge numbers of Palestinians who've been killed in this last year.
It would be foolish of us to think we can do that now.
So that prospect is also far away.
Unless there's a stop to the fighting and a commitment, a real commitment. Everything we've heard from this Israeli government suggests that they're not interested in a Palestinian state, which if that is one of our core requirements, I don't see, just logic follows that there's not much to talk about.
Well, let's come back to the here and now, Lebanon, as well as Gaza and the West Bank, and particularly this aim of getting even a temporary ceasefire. We've been talking so far in terms of incentives and long-term aims, but there's also international pressure, isn't there, which could be applied. So the US, Israel's strongest ally, wants it to have a ceasefire with Hezbollah, but also agrees a new military aid package. Are they wrong to do that?
Well, look, the whole international community has failed. The fact that we're still, that things are escalating means everyone has failed. It's wrong to apportion blame on one or the other. All of us have failed, and perhaps some have more responsibility than others. But I've said this before on your show, I think the world has a blind spot to Israel. Israel does things that under no other circumstances any other country could get away with and still be considered normal. I can't explain why, it just is what it is. And I think, you know, there is a lot more scope for pressure from the United States. And, you know, after the whole world is in New York now, hopefully some of the discussions will lead to a situation where people can feel they can apply the right, correct and fair pressure on Israel. And it's just what we're looking for is fairness, not something unfair and unjust on Israel. Israel has a right to defend itself.
That was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to London, Bin Bandar Al Saud. And as a reminder, we are waiting to hear from the Israeli Prime Minister. He's due to address the UN General Assembly at any moment now. For the meantime, let's speak to Daniel Desimoni, our correspondent in Jerusalem. Daniel, you don't have a crystal ball, but what are we expecting from Benjamin Netanyahu's speech?
Well, he's due to speak shortly. I expect he'll provide a defence of his government's policy, particularly its policy towards Gaza and Hamas, but also particularly with the current events in relation to Hezbollah and the way that they've been carrying out airstrikes on Hezbollah and other targeting of Hezbollah. Obviously, earlier in the week, well, actually yesterday, in fact, it became apparent that there was a 21-day ceasefire deal being spoken about, which was being proposed particularly by the United States and others. And Mr. Netanyahu gave the impression publicly initially that this was kind of a surprise to him and that he hadn't yet responded to it. I think it's since become clear that he had an awareness of that. And so I think we might see some balancing of his position in terms of showing that he's open to diplomacy, but also defending the military actions we've been seeing. So I think there'll be some balancing in terms of his public statement today at the UN.
And Daniel, several Israeli officials have been talking about the momentum they have right now on the Lebanese front.
Well, that's right. You've got members of Mr. Netanyahu's coalition government who are completely opposed to any kind of ceasefire deal with Hezbollah, just as they're opposed to any kind of ceasefire deal with Hamas relating to Gaza. And their position, particularly the security minister and the finance minister, that they must keep fighting and they must effectively destroy Hezbollah. They feel that Hezbollah's on the back foot and they've kind of got them where they want them. And certainly from various senior military figures, we've been hearing similar language about this is an opportunity. The head of the military said yesterday that they've been waiting for years, and that they must go in on the ground and destroy the enemy there. So that's certainly the rhetoric. And that rhetoric has really increased quite a lot from some people over the past week and a half since we've been seeing these attacks on Hezbollah, which, of course, followed the Israeli government formally setting this war goal of theirs, which is to return home 60,000 Israelis in the north of the country who've been displaced by Hezbollah rocket fire. And, of course, that goal has not been achieved, despite all the military action, because Hezbollah is still firing rockets as we speak today.
Now, as we've been speaking, in fact, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has taken the stage at the UN General Assembly. Daniel, thank you for that. We will come back to you potentially as this progresses. We'll also bring you some of the most important, significant moments from Benjamin Netanyahu's speech. Now, as a reminder, these talks come as the US allies, as well as key Arab states, have joined together over Washington's initiative for a ceasefire in Lebanon, so that, in Benjamin Netanyahu's words, they may stop the cross-border fighting. Netanyahu, meanwhile, says displaced Israelis need to return to their homes. Israel made this one of their key war aims. Again, as soon as we have more from that speech, we will bring that to you later in the programme. Now, the award-winning filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola is behind masterpieces such as Apocalypse Now and the Godfather series. And at 85, he's back putting $120 million of his own money into the futuristic Megalopolis. The film stars big hitters like Adam Driver, Aubrey Plaza and Dustin Hoffman. Take a listen to the trailer.
When does an empire die? Does it collapse in one terrible moment? No, no. But there comes a time when it's...
The reviews vary, with one in The New Yorker calling it the filmmaker's artistic rejuvenation, while the Daily Mail is calling it Megaflopolis. I spoke to film critic Ayana Murray.
This is the latest film from Francis Ford Coppola, and he's such a well-respected director. He's the person behind one of the greatest movies of all time, The Godfather, but he's not exactly operating on the same level he once was. His last film was 13 years ago, but Megalopolis is a very ambitious film. It's just under 2.5 hours long, and Coppola is essentially transposing the fall of ancient Rome to the decline of America, and it's not exactly subtle about it either. New York in the film is called New Rome, and Adam Driver is playing an architect who is trying to rebuild the city as a utopia.
And the trailer starts with the words, "One filmmaker has always been ahead of his time." What did you think? Did you agree?
You could say it's ahead of its time. I think the film is messy and oftentimes incoherent. It feels like Coppola's trying to stuff a dozen disparate ideas into one film without logic or reason. You know, at one point, Adam Driver performs the entire To Be or Not To Be monologue from Hamlet. There's a scene that's delivered in Latin for some reason. But at the same time, I feel like there's something admirable in a director that's shooting for the stars, not necessarily getting there, but trying all the same. I think in terms of it being ahead of its time, I saw the film for the first time at the Cannes Film Festival, not knowing anything that was going to happen. And there's a sequence in the film where, you know, a person in the cinema walks up on stage and essentially talks to Adam Driver through the screen. And I was in such a daze. It took me a couple of minutes to compose myself afterwards, because it felt like I was watching something that had never been done before, and that this isn't something that's going to be replicated again anytime soon. And I think you go to the cinema hoping for a singular experience, and Megalopolis delivers that.
There were some positive reviews, weren't there, though? What did critics admire about the film?
A lot of the critics have the same opinion that I have, which is that it's ambitious. And even though it can be a bit messy, there's something admirable in Coppola attempting to do all of this. Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian called it a bloated, boring, and bafflingly shallow film. I wouldn't say it's boring, but, you know, films are subjective. The New York Times said, quote, "It's a little bit nuts, but our movies could use more craziness." It's whether you're on board with what it's going for that's dividing the critics. And I think you could say that the film is even divisive by design. I don't think this is attempting to be an accessible, easily digestible film.
And Ayanna, it's star-studded. There's Adam Driver, Aubrey Plaza, Shia LaBeouf, Dustin Hoffman. Did you feel how star-studded it was?
Every second of the film, it feels like there's a new A-list actor in it. And I think that's a testament to the caliber of filmmaker that Coppola is, that people are willing to do anything to be in this film. I wouldn't necessarily say that everyone is successful, or it feels like every actor in this film is performing in a different movie that doesn't necessarily align together in the film. You mentioned Aubrey Plaza. She's playing this sort of ludicrously larger-than-life TV personality. And then Adam Driver, his character, Caesar Catalina, it doesn't feel like he has a humorous bone in his body. So the characters are all over the place, but I think that's part of the fun of the film.
That was film critic Ayanna Murray. This is Azdeh Mashiri with NewsHour live from the BBC. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been addressing the UN General Assembly in New York as Israel and Hezbollah continue to trade fire across the Lebanese border. This, of course, comes amid calls for a ceasefire. Much of what he's been saying has concerned the terrible events of October the 7th last year.
Thousands of Iranian-backed Hamas terrorists from Gaza burst into Israel in pickup trucks, on motorcycles. And they committed unimaginable atrocities. They savagely murdered 1,200 people. They raped and mutilated women. They beheaded men. They burned babies alive. They burnt entire families alive. Babies, children, parents, grandparents, in scenes reminiscent of the Nazi Holocaust. Hamas kidnapped 251 people from dozens of different countries, dragging them into the dungeons of Gaza. Israel has brought home 154 of these hostages, including 117 who returned alive. I want to assure you, we will not rest until the remaining hostages are brought home too.
Let's get some reaction to what the Israeli Prime Minister has been saying. Jonathan Panikoff is the director of Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative, and he joins us live from Washington, D.C. Jonathan, I realise that the speech has just begun and it's a few lines are coming through, but could you talk about the timing of this as there are all these calls for the ceasefire?
Absolutely, and great to be with you. Look, Prime Minister Netanyahu began his speech by saying he didn't expect to actually be there at the UN and making it today, but he felt he had to respond to what he had heard previously. The reality is this speech is unlikely to probably move anybody. One way or the other, it's probably unlikely to change the circumstance. But what is obviously, as you're noting, hanging overhead is a U.S., European, and allied push for a temporary 21-day pause between Hezbollah and Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu rejected it. He's walked that back a little bit last night. But I think we're still in this moment slightly of purgatory. I think it's really quite unclear how things are still going to go. And there could be a diplomatic off-ramp, but the chances for that are clearly narrowing the more and more you're seeing Hezbollah and Israel strike further and deeper into each other's territory.
And Jonathan, as Prime Minister Netanyahu has been speaking, some people have walked out of the room. Meanwhile, Israel has said that it has secured $8.7 billion in military aid from the US. What leverage do allies have over Israel as they push for this ceasefire?
I think this is what's so frustrating, and I can tell you for a fact it's no more frustrating to anybody than U.S. officials. The reality is U.S. leverage is not what I think a lot of folks around the world would hope that it is. There's been a lot of talk, for instance, about restricting weapons for the campaign into Gaza, now maybe into Lebanon. But even if you did that, Israel would still be able to fight this war, or both of the wars. It would just do so in a way that, frankly, might actually result in even more casualties, more civilian deaths, because you might not be as precise. U.S. pressure has helped change some military operations in Rafah, for instance, so that it looked much different than what we saw tragically in Khan Yunis in Gaza City at the beginning of the war in Gaza. I think that's a microcosm of what you would expect with Hezbollah.
And yet, Jonathan, what do you make of the timing, though, given the fact that the U.S. has grouped together key Arab states, its allies, to call for this temporary ceasefire? What do you make of the timing in sending more weapons, in providing more military aid?
So I think there's a slight disconnect here. The U.S. has long had a process in terms of when the weapons comes online, and those decisions are made, frankly, months ahead. And the U.S. has actually, to Israel's very big annoyance, slowed the path of weapons, and it stopped sending some of the bigger weapons. But the reality is U.S. leverage here is not going to be fundamentally sufficient to convince Prime Minister Netanyahu to either stop the war, to go forward, right, as much as we'd like that to think that it could.
Right. Jonathan Panikoff, thank you for that, your time. And if anyone wants more updates on Netanyahu's speech, please do visit our live page on the BBC website. Now, actress Dame Maggie Smith, known for the Harry Potter films and Downton Abbey, has died at the age of 89, her family has told us. A legend of British stage and screen, she won two Oscars during her career for The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie in 1970 and California Suite in 1979. Maggie Smith became a star on the classical stage as well, and on TV in roles such as Portia in The Merchant of Venice.
If he lose, he makes a swan-like end fading in music.
But comedy is what she did best.
I will not have you in the course of a single evening besmirching that name by behaving like a babbling, bumbling band of baboons.
Many listeners will also remember her portrayal of Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films.
That was bloody brilliant.
Oh, thank you for that assessment, Mr. Weasley. Perhaps it would be more useful if I were to transfigure Mr. Potter and yourself into a pocket watch. That way one of you might be on time.
And, of course, the Countess of Grantham in Downton Abbey.
When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly.
Colin Paterson is the BBC's entertainment correspondent. Colin, of course, she's a national treasure in the UK, but she had a global impact as well, didn't she?
Oh, absolutely, and over so many decades. 89 years old she was. We got this lovely statement from her family talking about how she leaves two sons, five loving grandchildren, just speaking how much they meant to them. And from listening to those clips, you realize how much she will mean to so many people around the world because of this variety of roles. For many, it will be Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films, for which people remember her for this character. I think people were frightened by in the early films, but then came to love. And another huge worldwide hit, Downton Abbey, as the Countess of Grantham, the master of the devastating put down in that series. And of course, in the last Downton Abbey film, she played her own character in the death scene for her character. So that was very much a final finale and a farewell to Downton Abbey. In fact, we've had a tribute this afternoon from Hugh Bonneville, her co-star in Downton Abbey, saying anyone who ever shared a scene with Maggie will attest to her sharp eye, her sharp wit, and formidable talent. She was a true legend of her generation and will live on in so many magnificent screen performances. Hugh Bonneville, Downton Abbey, summing up Dame Maggie Smith.
Colin Paterson, our BBC entertainment correspondent, thank you for that. That's all from us at NewsHour. Thanks for listening.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.